Thank you very much for the way too kind introduction. Hi everyone, it's a pleasure to be here. Also want to thank Latham for the invitation. It was a bit of a last minute thing. I got the invitation a few days ago, so the talk is not as polished as I would have liked, but I did do my effort best to make it as accessible as possible, especially since it's supposed to be a colloquium talk. And correspondingly, also feel free to interrupt at any point with comments or questions. Keeps things also a bit more lively and fun. Okay. So also, I guess everyone can hear me like this. So as the title suggests, wave function collapse, measurement will be a key part throughout this talk. And it's roughly, say, almost 90 years ago, right? That Schrödinger, of course, very famously made the point that measuring a state in quantum physics seems to be a rather drastic and dramatic thing to do, right? For example, our superposition might collapse into a particular state. In this case, don't worry, it's a sleeping cat. And so in this talk, we'll try to explore how measurement can be used to achieve something interesting and useful. Now, of course, the idea of measurement and wave function collapse doing something interesting is not new as such. For example, there's a famous quantum teleportation protocol, right, where Alice and Bob might be far away from one another. As long as they share some kind of Bell pair between the two, so you have two entangled qubits, then Alice can use that to essentially teleport some unknown state psi and some other qubit all the way to Bob. Now, just to remind you how that works is Alice decides to measure her two qubits in a Bell basis. And basically, these are the four possible Bell pairs, states you can have. And the measurement gives you basically four possible outcomes. But independent of the outcome, basically Bob gets the quantum state. Basically, the whole wave function is immediately collapsed into the state psi up to some single-site Pauli operators. And I should mention in this talk, I'll often use capital X, Y, and Z as denoting the Pauli matrices on a qubit. And basically, it's up to these some single-site Pauli operators. So as long as Alice transmits her classical information about which measurement outcome she got, Bob can reconstruct psi. So in other words, measurement allows to efficiently perform tasks which would have been very difficult in a purely quantum context, right? So the hard thing to do would just to ship this quantum state psi all the way across the universe to Bob. But somehow, measurement allows you to do all the difficulty in a purely classical channel, where you just need to transport the measurement outcome to Bob. OK, so we'll be exploring how measurement cannot be just used to do something useful, like in teleportation, but actually to also create entanglement. And so oftentimes, we think of measurement as destroying entanglement. You collapse the state, after all. But there is a sense in which measurement can even create an interesting state. So instead of collapsing Schrödinger's cat, we can actually create a cat state. And indeed, there's a very entangled state that sometimes goes by the name of a cat state, because it kind of captures the same physical picture of Schrödinger's cat experiment. So imagine we have n qubits in this macroscopic superposition of all 0 or all 1. Right? It's also famously called the GHZ state, after the people that first studied the entanglement properties of this state. And safe to say, it's a very entangled state, which also means that to create a state from, say, a product state is very difficult. You can make more precise, in particular, if you use only unitary parts of quantum physics, namely the stuff if you don't do measurement, you can show that it takes a really long time to create the state. Okay, so basically, the bigger the state is, the more time it will take to prepare it. That's as long as you don't use measurement. But it turns out using measurement, you can very efficiently create this very entangled state. What's the intuition? Or was the idea? So let's start with a simple state that everyone can prepare, an unentangled product state. But you choose it in the right basis, right? So instead of doing a product state of all zeros, let's do a product state in the x basis, right? So plus is just superposition of 0 and 1 locally, still a product state. But if you just expand it out in the 0 and 1 basis, right, to remind you, that just gives you all possible states in your Hilbert space, right? You get all 0 or all 1 and everything else. Right? That everything else makes it unentangled at the end of the day. But somehow, the part we would want to get is here. Right? So if somehow we could simply remove that part of the wave function, we would have very quickly created a GZ state. It's a bit like trying to create a beautiful sculpture, start with a big brick, and you just want to cut away the pieces you don't like, and you end up with something beautiful. And that's exactly what measurement can do for you. Right? It collapses things, so it can remove things of your wave function. So in particular, one measurement you can try to do on your product state is you can check, do all my neighboring spins point in the same direction. For example, are they both 0 or both 1? Right? You can do that measurement for all neighboring pairs. And of course, if you get that, if the measurement outcome is yes, they're always aligned, then you've collapsed everything here. The only two states consistent with that measurement outcome is the all 0 and the all 1 state, and you've gotten your GHZ state. Of course, that's a big if, right? Measurement outcome is random. But it turns out, no matter what the outcome is, you always create a GHZ state up to some single spin flips that you know what to do once you know the measurement outcome. So here, when, what I just said, you know, physically in terms of checking whether two spins are aligned, you know, this is the two-body observable that corresponds to that measurement, which can be plus or minus 1. And once you know the measurement outcome, you can always correct for it and get the GHZ state. Note that this is very similar to teleportation, right? Where no matter the measurement outcome that Alice gets, Bob always gets psi up to some Paulis, and you can always correct for those Paulis once you get the classical information outcome. Right? So this is how you can deterministically prepare the GHZ in finite time, in particular where we ignore the time it takes to do classical signaling and information processing. Okay, so this will be kind of inspiration for today's talk. Clearly, measurement is powerful. Wave function collapse can create very entangled states. And you could ask, can we use that collapse to create interesting many-body states of matter? Right? In a sense, you can think of GHZ state as a special case. But it's, of course, it's kind of interesting from, say, quantum information point of view. But as a state of matter, you know, it's kind of a ferromagnetic cat state. There are many more interesting states out there. Can we create those? Can we access those by harnessing the power of measurement to efficiently create them? Okay. And a recurring theme will also be what we just saw in both the teleportation and this example, is that measurements speed things up by basically pushing stuff to the classical level. And once you have your classical measurement outcome, you can do some patching up to get the desired state. And that speeds up things dramatically. Okay. So first, the good. So indeed, there's the question, can we use this amazing power of measurement to create interesting types of many-body entangled states? Can we create exotic phases of matter? Indeed, this is how I and my collaborators kind of entered into this field as such. We actually started with the goal of creating interesting phases of matter, and then kind of were led onto this path of using measurement because it's simply so powerful. So our starting point was kind of being inspired by all these amazing quantum devices that are being developed, and then in recent years have really reached kind of a many-body quantum level, where in the labs one is no longer, you know, tinkering with just a few qubits, but one can create large amounts of qubits that are entangled in interesting ways. For example, you know, Rydberg atom tweezer arrays, or atoms trapped in optical lattices, or superconducting qubit chips, or later in this talk we'll also see cold ions. And what all these platforms have in common is that they concern, you know, considerable amount of qubits, degrees of freedom, where you exactly know what their interaction is and when they interact. But moreover, you can even determine this. You have control over it. You can choose maybe the geometry or when they interact or how strongly they interact. And you have also real power of doing measurement in your state, both potentially in terms of just kind of getting information of what state you have, but also perhaps doing measurement in this active way that I was just advocating, using wave function collapse to your advantage to create interesting entangled states. Okay, so you know, now that these devices are, you know, up and coming, the natural question is, can we use them to create these exotic states? And there have been some advances in recent years. I highlight two. I'm not trying to say this is the only ones, but these are just two, and one of which we were involved in, which is, say, on the left-hand side, this is an experimental work from the Lucan lab at Harvard, where they trap atoms in optical tweezers to get arbitrary geometries. And on the right-hand side, it's from a paper by Google, where they have superconducting qubits that they can couple in particular ways. And in both cases, although the approach is very different, in both cases, one is trying to realize a phase of matter that goes by a variety of names. But you know, just to name drop something, it's called Z2 topological order. That might not mean something to all of you, but I will discuss in a moment what are topological phases of matter precisely. For now, let's just say there's something interesting and exotic about them. And for example, here we're trying to realize it as a low energy state of an interacting system. And here, Google is trying to create it by a gate-based approach, where one is entangling qubits pairwise to eventually create a very interesting entangled state. Okay, so these are kind of fun and impressive experiments, but intriguingly, as an opportunity, they also highlight challenges for the future, which is that both kind of have a bottleneck that hurts scaling and future experiments. Right? So in particular, the experiment from in the Rydberg Adam Tweezer area context is trying to create a low energy ground state by doing adiabatic state approximation, where basically one tunes parameters in the Hamiltonian to the desired region of parameter space. But it is known to be very slow because you're basically trying to sweep through a phase transition. You have to do it very slow. And of course, that means the upshot I want you to take away from this is that the time it takes to prepare these states will scale with system size. So it's not inherently scalable. Similarly, but distinct, in the Google experiment, they're doing a gate-based approach, like entangling qubits pairwise. There's no Hamiltonian picture as such, but more like a controlled entangling operation. But similarly, the kind of wave function they're trying to create, there's very deep fundamental bounds, which show that the bigger the wave function you want to create, the deeper your circuit must be, the longer it must take. So in both cases, there's this scaling issue. The bigger state you want to prepare, the longer time it takes. And why is this a fundamental issue? Well, you know, these quantum devices, they have a restricted coherence time. Eventually, after a certain time, your system decoheres with the environment, your quantumness is gone. So you have quite a strict time budget, okay? And basically, you run out of steam before you can create big systems, okay? So that proposes a challenge, and that's how we started thinking about using measurement to speed things up, because measurement has this amazing power, right, that it can collapse a whole wave function at once. Perhaps it can speed up the preparation of these interesting states. And along the way, we hopefully also learn something interesting about, you know, fundamental relations between measurement and unitary and phase of matter. So indeed, that was a kind of the motivating question. Can we use measurement to create these states? And we are by no means the first to start asking that question. There's some very nice works that I'll also touch on more in a moment. But we try to contribute to this and also try to bring this into kind of experimental reality. So in particular, last week, we released a new preprint trying to use these measurement-based approaches to create a very exotic state of matter called non-abelian topological order. And part of the purpose of today's talk is also kind of unpacking what does that mean. And this is using a very recent upgrade in Quantinuum's cold ion processor that we'll be exploring as well. So in fact, I think Latham he read the Quanta magazine article, and this is why he invited me. It's kind of last minute, so at least, you know, something good comes out of these Quanta magazine things. So good. So that brings me to the outline of the rest of this talk. So I already kind of name dropped topological order, but I haven't really explained at all what that's supposed to mean. So especially since it's a colloquium, I'll try to, you know, introduce this notion. And convince you, well, first of all, explain what is topological order and hopefully convince you along the way that it's interesting and worthwhile to explore. And then I'll give you a taste of how we think measurement can speed things up to create these interesting topological order states. And then lastly, that sets us up for discussing the recent implementation of a particular type of topological order called non-abelian topological order. So that's where we're heading. Any questions or comments at the moment?
So before we go, the very naively speaking, the main idea is that instead of building a state that is highly entangled from the beginning, you build something that is easily built, like the product state, and then you want to use measurement of this state to create this.
Correct, yeah. And we try to collapse it in an interesting way.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
The wave function collapse is controversial. Different interpretations that are not like wave function collapse. Like, this is just theoretical. I mean, this what you're telling us, it depends on quantum entanglement.
Right. So I agree. There's different interpretations of like the measurement process. And I would say the way I'm talking about it is kind of agnostic about interpretation. So indeed, you know, kind of the quick and fast way of talking about it is as collapse. But indeed, for example, right, there's many worlds or other interpretations where there's no intrinsic collapse. Either way, in all possible interpretations, something drastic happens. Right? In many worlds, you're entangling yourself with the system. Right? And what looks like a classical channel is just, you know, even bigger quantum channel that just involves you, and you think it's classical. So one can, of course, describe everything in that way. So I think the main upshot of measurement is that it allows you to push operations from what seems to be a quantum channel into a classical channel. Ultimately, that classical channel might be quantum in a bigger redefinition of our wave function. But somehow, in practice, we feel that classical channel definitely feels at a different level. Right? We've much more. It's much easier for Alice to send classical information to Bob, independent of interpretation. Right? Even if ultimately you can interpret in a different way.
Just depending interpretation.
Yeah, I would say yeah. But yeah, good. Thanks for the question. Good. Any other questions, comments?
Sorry. Similar thing.
Yeah.
As you, in one of the interpretation of measurement, you get entangled with the apparatus.
Yes.
So you're doing so many measurements. So how do you take care of that entanglement with the rest of the world apparatus?
So that's more of a practical question, right? I guess you're kind of asking, how do you know that your measurement outcome is faithful and not that along the way you're entangled with other things? And yeah, there's no easy answer. That's why it's so hard to build these machines. And for example, these new chapter-end processors, they try to quantify to what extent is their measurement faithful, right? For example, the way to test it is you think you know how to prepare a certain state. You do a measurement a little bit later. You check, do I correctly get out what I know I've put in? Right, and they can compound how good that fidelity is, and it's really amazingly good at these, 99% fidelity.
One interpretation is that the quantum entanglement gets entangled with the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So your experiment is done in an environment.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the environment affect this result? People here.
Oh, well, okay, it's an interesting question. What happens with decoherence? There's much more to be said. You could, this GZ state preparation, for example. What if your thing is not perfect? It's slightly leaking to the environment, right? Like I was talking about preparing this GZ state by a measurement. You could ask, what if there's decoherence along the way? And people are exploring these properties. We have one work on it in some sense. I think it's an interesting question. It depends on what precisely your coupling is. And perhaps one interesting upshot that seems to come out is, depending on the type of state you're trying to create, it is more or less sensitive. In particular, in certain cases, we think it can be stable to decoherence. Perhaps 3D topological states might have some intrinsic stability to certain types of imperfections. But what I mean to want to get across is it's interesting, people are studying, and it's case dependent. So I don't have a single line answer, but I guess we study it as we go along. Good, thanks. Okay, let me go on. So I want to give you either, depending on who you are, a brief review or a brief introduction to topological order. And so essentially what topological order is supposed to be, it's a type of entanglement between many degrees of freedom. And that entanglement is supposed to be interesting in ways that I'll try to explain. But to get intuition for what it means for entanglement to be interesting, or where should we look for it, we can actually get inspiration from a single Bell pair. Right? So if you just think of two qubits again, right? When is entanglement there? Clearly, it relies on having superposition between your two qubits. But you want the right amount of superposition, right? If you have a product state, that's not interesting. But if you have the superposition of all possible basis states, it's also not interesting. It's a product state in the other basis. So somehow the Bell pair that we know and love is the right amount of superposition. So one way of trying to make that a bit more precise that we can generalize is we want the maximal superposition of all states that satisfy a constraint. So the constraint eliminates certain parts of our Hilbert space. For example, in this case, I only want to consider states that point in the same direction. And then I take the maximal superposition. This combining of constraints and superposition turns out to be a very natural way to find interesting types of entanglement. For example, the GZ state is a very direct generalization, where I only consider aligned spins and then take the superposition, which is the all-up or all-down state. But the GZ state is maybe not one of the most interesting entangled states. And there is because the constraint is a bit too constraining. It kicks out too many states. So we'll try to use this intuition to create other more interesting states. OK, so let's start, again, with infinitely many spins. And for convenience, I'm going to put them on the links of the square lattice. Here, I just show one possible snapshot of my 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. And now, first, I'm going to impose a constraint, right? I don't want to consider all possible states. just like the bell pair. And the constraint I'm going to impose maybe looks a bit funny at first, but bear with me. The constraint I want to impose is around every vertex, I want that an even number of spins point down. OK, so for example, here, 0 spins point down. Here, 2 spins, 4 spins. So I show you a little snapshot that satisfies this constraint. Here, I just wrote it as an operator identity, but visually, it's already clear. Well, what this actually buys us is it's a loop model. I don't know if you can see, but if you trace the red arrows, they kind of form a closed loop, right? So indeed, if we use this visual representation, say an upspin, I denote it just as a black edge, and a downspin, I color that edge, right? Then the previous state I wrote, let me just go back, with this visual representation, is just a closed loop state. Okay? So instead of considering all 2 to the n states, I'm going to consider the subspace of only closed loop states using this encoding. That's my constraint. It still leaves exponentially many states, okay? But now I'm going to take the superposition of all such states. Okay? So again, we're doing this balance of a non-trivial constraint and superposition. And then at the end of the day, I end up writing the following wave function. Okay? It's a superposition of all closed loop states. Good. So okay, it's easy enough to define, but why should it be interesting? Well, it turns out this wave function, it might be familiar to some of you, is a kind of very celebrated and interesting wave function. It goes by different names. But maybe famously, it's also known as a toric-code state. It's for historical reasons that I really won't go really into. One way of characterizing this state is as it's as the ground state of a particular four-body interacting Hamiltonian. You can write it like this, where the two terms in the Hamiltonian exactly enforce what I just said. One term introduces this closed loop condition. The other term enforces the fact that you have a superposition of all such states. Okay? But that's just a rephrasing of what I already said. And this toric-code Hamiltonian has been studied for decades now, has a bunch of interesting properties. But you might very well ask, if this is the first time you're seeing this wave function, why should it be interesting? In what sense is this an interesting entangled state? Well, one very interesting property of this wave function is its local excitations, or if I locally deform the state. Okay. So how can I try to deform it? Well, I can start flipping some spins. Okay. So let's say along this line here, I'm going to flip 3 spins, right? So on those bonds, I'm going to act with Pauli X, right? Flip 0 to 1, 1 to 0, or visually, it will flip a black bond to red bond and vice versa. Okay, so let me act on it. Okay, of course, you can see what's going to happen. Okay, I get this state. Okay, what's the point? Almost everywhere, this is still a superposition of closed loop states, except at the beginning and end point of where I acted with my Pauli spin flips, right? Here I have an open string, and here I have an open string in all branches of the wave function, right? In other words, in some meaningful sense, I have a local excitation here. Only here can I tell something happened, and I have a local excitation here, okay? Terminology-wise, this is called an E particle. In a moment, actually, maybe it will become clear why E particle, but let's just treat it as a name for now. And why are these interesting? Well, what's very peculiar is that these are local excitations, right? I have one here and one here. But you can easily convince yourself you can't create a single one locally, right? As soon as I have an open string here, I know by following it, it's going to end somewhere else, right? So even though they're local excitations, they cannot be created locally. There's kind of an interesting tension between locality and non-locality. And this interesting tension allows these so-called quasi-particles or particles, whatever you want to call them, to have very rich and exotic properties. So what are those properties? Well, but let me first mention that in addition to this E particle, there's other particles by acting with the other Pauli operators. So I haven't shown it, but maybe you can believe me. Just like there's an E particle, there's something that people call M and F, right? Again, they just look similar to this, just a different name. But it turns out, surprisingly, that some of them, namely these F particles, they're a fermion. And this really should shock you, especially if this is the first time you hear about this, because we started with a Hilbert space of spins. That's spin halves. This could be well defined in a universe without fermions, okay? And then we introduced entanglement between these spins, right? And suddenly the emergent excitations or quasi-particles behave like fermions. In particular, these F particles, if you exchange them, you can show that the wave function picks up a minus one sign, right? That's the defining property of a fermion. So it's really this rich emergence is a consequence of this rich type of interesting type of entanglement. And it's a kind of a fun aside that what I'm telling you now is not some fine-tuned property of this wave function, but it's actually a property of a whole so-called phase of matter. And we're just talking about nice particular instantiations of that phase of matter. That's just maybe an aside for the purpose of this talk. OK, so we see that by considering this closed loop state and the superpositions of closed loops, we get an entangled state with interesting emergent particles. And it turns out there's actually a deeper perspective on what is going on. Actually, maybe I should pause and see if there's any questions about what I said so far. OK, so let me give you a deeper perspective, which is not due to me, but it's a deeper perspective that I love to share, is that what's going on is the emergence of a gauge theory, right? So we can kind of first see this by analogy, right? If we take a step back, let's not think of fancy quantum entanglement and qubits. Let's just think of classical electromagnetism for a moment. We can think of electric fields as forming closed loops. That's kind of what the Gauss law is telling us, right? In other words, a rephrasing of electric flux through a closed surface is zero. So electric field lines are closed. They can only start and end at charges of our gauge theory, right? And in fact, on a compact universe, as soon as you have a source, somewhere there must be a sink. I hope this sounds familiar. So you have local particles that look local, right? But somehow they cannot exist by themselves. They can only be created in charge anti-charge pairs. This is very similar to what we saw on the previous slide. In fact, the similarities are more than the differences. The differences are kind of almost subtle and technical. Is that whereas electromagnetism is known to be U1 gauge theory, we have U1 symmetry, as you might well know. In the previous slide, this toric code state has an emergent gauge group given by Z2. Okay, so it's kind of a smaller subgroup of U1, which of course has some interesting consequences, but by and large, they have more commonalities than differences. So we see that entangling simple degrees of freedom like qubits can give rise to emergent gauge fields with emergent charges, etc. Okay, so it's kind of a really remarkable property of quantum entanglement that it can do that for us. And there's a more general perspective here of that these emergent particles in these entangled states are so-called anions. So what are anions? Well, we know in our usual 3+1D dimensional universe, things tend to be either bosons or fermions, right? If you exchange them, we know you get a ±1 phase factor. But people have realized almost 50 years ago that if you restrict yourself to two spatial dimensions, that particles can transform much more non-trivially when you exchange them. And they don't just need to pick up a ±1. And when they have these more generalized properties, they might pick up, say, a phase factor. People call them anions. This is a name by Wilczek. Anions, basically anything can happen once you exchange them, roughly speaking, is kind of the intuition. And for example, in the simplest case, people call them abelian anions, that if you, for example, here I'm showing it for this particular case of the toric code. If we read this as a function of time, first out of the toric code state, which we think of the vacuum, I create a pair of e particles, which I can do with the string operator, for example. And I also create a pair of these other m particles, which some other string operator that I didn't draw for you. And if then as a function of time, I link their world lines and then fuse them back, right? I seem to get back to the original wave function. But you can show that the wave function has toggled its signs, -1. So they have some interesting braiding statistics that's neither bosonic or fermionic, because the fermions would actually be +1. So there's some generalized exchange statistics going on here. And the fact we get a phase factor refers to it being an abelian anion. OK. And so we know theoretically these things can happen, as shown by many beautiful works over the years. And also remarkably, even though it was originally introduced out of kind of mathematical beauty and people playing around and trying to understand fundamental structures of braiding, it was later found that it can occur in nature. In particular, it can spontaneously arise in certain solid-state systems, namely the fraction quantum Hall states, which I won't really go into. Safe to say there's some very interesting solid-state systems where the low-energy quasi-particles exactly are these kind of anions. Okay, and there's very interesting recent experiments that even further confirm this picture. Also, more recently, a few years ago, Google created this toric code wave function, created these anions, did the braiding, and again found these phase factors that we already knew should be there analytically, but it shows that they can actually be created and controlled with present day devices. OK, so these entangled states don't just give rise to emerging case theories, but even to these anionic exchange statistics, which are very rich and interesting excitations. And a kind of a real, culmination of this exotic nature arises in the most exotic type of anions, which are so-called non-abelians, non-abelian anions. So when you braid these, the wave function doesn't just pick up a phase factor, but something more non-trivial happens. Basically, these anions come equipped with an internal space. And as you braid them, you're actually acting with a whole matrix on that internal space. If that sounds arcane and exotic, actually think of quantum chromodynamics, right? Quarks, right? They transform non-trivially under the SU3 gauge group. Correspondingly, they come with a color label, right? And whenever you when you do stuff with quarks, even more important in two spatial dimensions, you have to ask what happens to the internal color label, okay? And that's what happens with these non-abelian anions. They have an internal label, internal Hilbert space, that transforms very non-trivially under braiding. Okay, so what is an observational consequence of this? Well, if these were, say, world lines of non-abelian anions, okay, I could create them out of the vacuum, two different pairs, I could braid them, and when I try to fuse them, I might not be able to get back to the vacuum, but I might produce some new third type of anion that kind of remembered the fact that I braided them and acted with some kind of matrix action. And this idea is the working principle of what Kitaev introduced in the late 90s as topological quantum computation, which is kind of at that time, like a real kind of paradigm shift, I would say, where you think of, okay, so the fact that you have this internal space, just like quarks have these internal color labels, let's imagine storing quantum information in that internal space, and let's imagine manipulating quantum information by braiding particles around each other. And Kitaev worked out that once you can control and create the right states with the right types of non-abelian anions, you can achieve interesting types of universal computation this way. But unlike the abelian anion case, it's even more challenging to find these states. So many theoretical beautiful models are known. So we understand theoretically the structure of these non-abelian anions and the states that are that give rise to them very well. It's very hard to find physical realizations. Even the fraction quantum Hall effect, which definitely gives very convincing evidence for the abelian case, it's still work in progress to find clear-cut arguments for non-abelian states. In particular, one of the fraction quantum Hall plateaus, is very likely to be a non-abelian state, but always more promising indication. But I would say it's not as clear-cut as the abelian case. Okay, so that kind of concludes my introduction to topological order, giving you a taste. I hope I gave you some sense, but let me know if there was particularly confusing aspects. So, to summarize, theoretically at least, it's known that if you have just a bunch of qubits which look pretty innocent, as long as you're able to entangle them in the right way, that they're that can give rise to lots of interesting emergent properties, like the emergence of quasi-particles with potentially abelian or non-abelian exchange statistics, and that these properties are very interesting and potentially useful for quantum computation many years down the road. So that then brings us to how can we create these states, or can we create these states, right? And in the beginning, I tried to give you a sense that trying to create these states in these controlled quantum devices without measurement is very challenging because you run out of time, basically. Right? There's so much entanglement, you can't create it in a finite amount of time. So as was nicely summarized here, the idea will be to instead create a simple state and use measurement in the right ways to collapse the state into these rich entangled states. And indeed, it's for a good reason. So here I'm kind of recapping that if we were not to use measurement, we only use the unitary part of quantum physics, right, the Schrodinger equation, if you wish, you just cannot efficiently repair topological order. There's very deep and beautiful proofs about this. Right? So for example, if you're trying to create a story code wave function, this was this equates a proposition of loop states, you can show that this is starting with a product state. You can't do it in finite time by just doing local entangling gates. But perhaps measurement can speed things up. And indeed, for the simple case of the toric code, which was the equal weight superposition of loops, it is known and been argued, I think this is the first reference I'm aware of, that you can efficiently prepare such states by using measurement. Okay, kind of similar to what we saw with the quantum teleportation or with this GHZ state preparation in the beginning of this talk. So apparently it's known how to do it. So let me give you a quick sense of what how does measurement produce this interesting Toric code state. Here's just a little reminder of a slide we had a while ago. So this was a state, right, we introduced. And just a reminder, there's a graphical notation for just spin or qubits living on the bonds of the square lattice, right? And we want to create this interesting entangled states in a very quick way using measurement. So basically, that comes down to kind of creating a state that's invariant under both of these terms in the Hamiltonian, right? And you create the ground state. OK, so similar to the GHZ state, we will use measurement to carve out the pieces we don't want. Right? We will start with some simple to prepare big state, but unentangled, chisel away the parts we don't like, and end up with a beautiful entangled state. And just like for the GHZ state, our initial state will be a product state in the X basis. Right? To remind you again, that's an equal superposition of all possible states in the Hilbert space. Right? In particular, it's a superposition of all closed loop states, but also all open string states. And we want to use measurement to kick out the open strings, right? So what that means physically, for every vertex of the lattice, you want to measure this four-body observable, right? If you find that that observable is one, it tells you, oh, there's only closed loops passing through this vertex. And then voila, you've collapsed into the toric code state. Of course, the natural next question is, but what if I don't get one? If measurement is random, you might sometimes get minus one. But just like in the other protocols I discussed in the beginning, as soon as you know your measurement outcome, you always know how to correct for it very quickly. And you can always deterministically prepare the toric code in this way. OK, so that's kind of the scheme, which is not laid out quite this way in this paper, but essentially it's the spirit of that. OK. So maybe two natural questions, or at least what I was wondering at this point is, OK, that all sounds good and well theoretically, but can this actually be done? Or is it just some, fun game to play? And also, how general is it, right? So it works for the toric code, but how much structure did we use? Or can it just do anything? OK, so for can this really be done an experiment, we had a preprint a few months ago where we actually, in collaboration with Quantinium, we used their cold ion device to literally do this process. Right? So we prepared a product state, we did the measurements, and then we did feed-forward correction to deterministically prepare toric code. And basically, it works. And so in the interest of time, I'm not planning to really discuss that. And I want to instead, motivated by this, that apparently this is not science fiction, let's say, OK, given that at least in certain simple cases, like toric code, it can be done with existing quantum devices, let's see how far can we go, both theoretically, what kind of states are in principle accessible via measurement, and then can we actually also do those as well? And here I want to highlight actually a challenge that we were stuck on for a while, which is if you look at what's happening under the hood or why the previous thing works, you can become dispirited with trying to generalize it. Right? Because what's kind of happening if you abstract away a little bit from the product state and the start term measurements, et cetera, what's kind of happening is we're measuring the charges of our kind of, I told you that the toric code is like a Z2 gauge theory. And these E charges are similar to the electric charges we know in electromagnetism. And our measurement is telling you, oh, I have an E anion here, an E anion here, E anion here, not here, I have one here. And once you have that information, you pair them up, clean up your state, so that you have a clean toric code wave function. And that's the kind of physical reinterpretation of the previous slide. But that seems very hard to generalize, because it's crucial that in this last step, in this correction step where we use our classical measurement outcome to correct, it's important that correction step is simple. Once I know where my E anions are, I can easily create them, right? A few slides ago, I showed you just a string of Pauli X's creates or destroys them. That's simple enough once you know where to do it. But it turns out for these more exotic states, where I mentioned non-abelian states with these non-abelian anions, if you try to mimic this process, what you would try to do, OK, I want to create an interesting non-abelian state by starting with something simple, then measuring where are my non-abelian anions, maybe here, 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 here. And now I need to pair them up. That's step two. But you can actually prove you cannot efficiently do that in the non-abelian case. Basically, instead of a Pauli X, the very object you need to pair them up is basically as complicated as a thing to prepare the whole state without measurement. Okay. So it seemed we in the beginning were a bit worried that okay, maybe we can't. But then with my lovely collaborators, Nathan Nivasarakarn, Ryan Torngren, and Ashwin Vishwanath, we did find a generalization that kind of reinterprets the previous thing, like the story code example. But it also couches it in a more general perspective. And that general perspective then applies both to the toric code case or non-abelian state and other interesting states. Right? So it's kind of a, I would say, a very useful tool to do many interesting things with a simple tool. And the key idea, which I don't imagine to, I can't really go into much detail, especially also in the context of the colloquium talk, but I'll give you some flavor of what this key tool is. Basically, what we're doing is using measurement to implement a transformation called gauging, okay? Making gauge theories, so to speak. Sometimes also called the Kramers-Vanier transformation. In some sense, you can think of it as a many-body version of quantum teleportation, okay? Not teleportating from qubit to qubit, but from Hilbert space to Hilbert space. Okay, so what is this gauging map that we know how to implement apparently? So the Kramers-Vanier map or gauging map is quite an old piece of literature. It goes back to the early days of lattice gauge theory. Okay, and it's essentially a map between two different Hilbert spaces. Okay, so for example, you might have a quantum state living on qubits on the sides of the square lattice. Right? You can take any wave function you like on that lattice. And there's some map which maps it to a different Hilbert space of qubits living on the links of the square lattice. So any wave function on the left maps to some wave function on the right. And as the name suggests, this map is somehow related to gauge theories. So what it's supposed to convey is you start with some wave function with a physical symmetry, for example, spin flip symmetry. And this map maps it to a state with a gauge symmetry. It's maybe a bit similar to, right, if you're doing a course in QFT, you might start with some scalar field, right, with a physical U1 symmetry, and you say, let's gauge it. So you couple it to a U1 gauge field. You have a new theory, right? It's not the same as the original theory, but there's like a protocol. Starting from a simple thing, you get this gauge theory. It's kind of a lattice version of that, okay? And it's been enjoyed for many decades as a useful mathematical tool to create, say, interesting gauge theories on the lattice. And here I just, here's just one way of defining the map by showing how operators transform. But maybe just to give you a sense, for example, if I choose the product state on this, the output of this gauging map is a toric code wave function. Just to convey that this is a very non-trivial map. You start with something unentangled, you put it through this map, and you get a very entangled state. But you can put any input state. It doesn't have to be the product state. You know, your favorite Z2 symmetric state, and you produce some interesting state in your gauge theory. And the main point is that if you try to actually do this map, it's ridiculous. It's a very entangling map. It's an absolute mess. So I don't think people would really think of it as a physical thing to do. It's just a very convenient mathematical mapping. But surprisingly, or at least surprising to me, is that there's a very simple way of implementing this map experimentally by doing measurement. Okay, and I'm not planning to unpack it. I just wanted to flash what it looks like. But somehow the idea is we know how to implement a gauging map, say, from qubits on one Hilbert space to qubits on the other. For example, in the previous slide, this will be the square lattice. This will be qubits on the square lattice, and here will be qubits on the bonds of the square lattice by doing a very simple procedure where we use some ancilla, some local entangling gates, and some measurement. Okay? And just like in all the previous slides, measurement is random, but you can show that as long as you're trying to gauge an abelian symmetry, like Z2, you can always correct for the measurement outcome very simply. Okay?
Which are the measurements here in this picture?
So if you want to, well, it depends. Like, let's say time runs up, then these are extra ancilla. Like, my original state is on blue. I load extra ancillas. I do some local entangling, and then I measure blue. What I showed there was the measurement outcome of all plus on blue. And then if some blue qubits are minus, we can do some simple Pauli spin flip to correct to always deterministically get to the all plus outcome, like the other protocols I was mentioning before.
So the sequence of measurements doesn't matter.
No, all at once. You can do it all at once. Yeah, they all commute with each other. If you want like a one sentence intuition for what's happening, for those of you familiar with lattice gauge theory, we're actually measuring the Gauss law operator and hence pushing our state into a lattice gauge theory. But if that doesn't help, just ignore it. But there's some circuit that does this interesting map, and it's, you know, once you know this map, it's actually quite simple to prove that it implements this map. But I won't go through it.
There's a question.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I'm not sure that I understand. So does this solve the pairing problem that you mentioned earlier?
Oh, great. Yeah. Okay. So I'll get to that. Yeah. So So I would say this indeed ends up solving it.
Okay.
But I would say it's not yet clear why.
Okay.
But this is like the key thing. This is like a crank we can now turn, and it can kind of get around it. It can prepare states that would have gotten stuck if you tried to do the naive thing of measuring non-abelians and not being able to pair them up. But I'll get to it in a moment, actually.
Okay. Thank you.
So just to make sure, the blue lines here are the origin of spins, and the red lines are dual spins.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess by virtue of the symmetry, I could have done it either way. But yeah, the way I was talking about it now would run up, for example. Yeah. OK. Let me just flash through the following, which I won't really. I just want to give you a sense of what it would look like in practice. So someone gives you a state on a square lattice. And now they ask, OK, produce to me the gauge version. Make it a gauge theory. So I don't need to know what your state is, similar to Alice and Bob, right? And teleporting the state psi. I don't need to know. I just insert some ancillas on the bonds. I do some local entangling operations. These are all finite depth. You can do them in parallel. And then I measure my original qubits, which was blue. OK. I might get some minus one outcomes, like in response to Subir's question. If they were all plus, I would be done. But I have some minus ones here. These are my so-called E anions. I pair them up. Again, this is similar to Bob correcting his teleported state. And the claim is, at the end of the day, I have deterministically created the gauged state. OK. And if you take the special case of the input state being the product state, you would recover the known protocol of the Torrey code. But it's more general. But why does it help to have more general states? Well, this now relates to your question about how do we solve this issue with non-abelians. So non-abelian anions are more rich and arguably more interesting. For example, they have a link to more power in quantum computation. I don't really want to drag it in that direction. But I tried to convey before that trying to create non-abelian by measurement seemed to have this naive issue. Once you know you have a non-abelian, you can't pair them up quickly. But how can we get around it? And here I really want to give credit to Nat Tantivasarakarn, who's a collaborator and really kind of saw this beautiful workaround, which is because now we have a protocol where we can input any state. It doesn't have to be a product state. So we can do it multiple times. Right, I can start with a product state, do this protocol, and for example, I get the Torrey code state, like we already said. But now this can be my input for another round. So I can kind of bootstrap my way up. And perhaps surprisingly, this can get you to non-abelian topological order. But if that sounds surprising, actually, I can give you some quick intuition. Think of the symmetry group of the triangle, right? The S3 permutation of three elements. That's a non-abelian group. For example, rotations don't commute with reflection. But individually, rotations and reflection are abelian, right? Z3 and Z2. Their interplay is non-abelian. But that's fine. So basically, it turns out you can create a state with non-abelian S3 topological order by going through the sequence. First, you perhaps create, first you gauge the Z3 symmetry, then you gauge some other Z2 symmetry. At each step, you only do abelian things. You can clean up stuff, correct for it, just like in quantum teleportation. At the end of the day, you have a non-abelian state. And moreover, you could ask, OK, how general is it that I can write a group as a successive number of abelian extensions? That's kind of what Galois defined as a symmetry group being solvable or not. And we think that anything that you cannot get this way, you can't get in any way using measurement. Although I want to point out a nice work by Tim, where they show that more generally, even in cases where we can't use our protocol, you can prepare non-solvable cases by doing a log depth circuit. OK, so that kind of gets around the non-abelian issue by seemingly only doing abelian things, but at the end of the day, coming up with abelian stuff. Now, so that kind of rounds up our way of thinking about how to do interesting stuff with measurement. Should I wrap in 5 minutes or sort of stop? Or what's the
5 to 10, I guess.
OK.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me try to wrap up in 5 minutes to, because perhaps maybe the most exciting part is the realization, but I do feel like we've done a lot of groundwork. So now we can kind of breeze through actually doing it, especially since we don't have to do the actual hard work of the experiment. So I can just show pretty pictures of the beautiful results that they got with their machine. And of course, I here want to very much acknowledge my wonderful collaborators. So far, the theory work was with Nat, Ryan, and Ashvin. And in this collaboration, the theory collaborators are Nat and Ashvin together with the Quantinuum team. And so as I mentioned before, half a year ago, we did a Torrey code case where we created a Torrey code. But it was on their 20-qubit device. And we worked really hard trying to, OK, in 20 qubits, can we squeeze a non-abelian state? And we just couldn't make it work. I told Henrik, who was kind of our lead contact at Quintinium, like, I can't make it work with 20 qubits. I think 27 qubits is the minimal we need. I was kind of disappointed, like, okay, we have to stop. And then he kind of told me, like, actually, you know, please sign this NDA. Okay, and I can tell you, we're actually about to launch a machine with 30 qubits. We're like, okay, cool. So then we got thinking about how to create a non-abelian state with their new device. And I do want to quickly advertise their amazing machine. So they have a separate preprint about the actual machine. So if you're interested in details about that, I can point to this reference. And so if you're wondering what's happening under the hood, so they basically trap ions. In this case, like they call it the racetrack geometry. And the current device, although they can scale it up, the current device has 32 qubits trapped. And they have amazing fidelity. So they can basically, you know, say, OK, they can do arbitrary connectivity between any two ions. And on any two ions, they can implement the gate with amazing fidelity. And also, crucially, these ions, the quantum coherence time is seconds. So they really have time to do measurement, classical processing, feed forward, to do all the correction step to try to implement these ideas of using measurement to create states. And yeah, I'm just really impressed. And I don't have any stock in, you know, Quintinium or anything. Just I'm sharing my amazement at what they're building. Also, if you check the quantum volume, which is some way of, you know, objectively measuring and comparing between different platforms how good a quantum computer is, you see that their exponential growth has been quite impressive in recent years. So with that, let's say we want to use their beautiful platform to create a non-abelian topological state using this kind of gauging or Kramers-Vanier picture. And then we try to identify the simplest state, but interesting non-abelian state that would fit on their device. And you know, there's a technical way of introducing it, which I won't spend any time on. Just for the experts in the audience, what we do is we start with a simple state. I won't even read it out because it sounds scary for perhaps many of you. There's some simple to prepare state. It's a bit like a product state with some extra fluff. And then we apply our map, this map I showed before, right? And it turns out you can understand, importing some, you know, literature knowledge, that this will produce a non-abelian state. So instead of spending time on that, I just want to show you a nice picture. Just like for the toric code, right? I said this is equal weight superposition of closed loop states. Fortunately, for this non-abelian state, there's an equally simple picture. This is slightly more exotic, of course, it has to be, it's non-abelian, but still very simple. What we do is we imagine three loop models interleaved on top. So I have can you see there's a blue honeycomb lattice, a red honeycomb lattice, and a green honeycomb lattice. And now on each of those, I'm going to consider closed loop states. Okay. If each were just individually in a superposition, I would just have three copies of toric code. That's not interesting. So of course, they'll be coupled in an interesting way. And it's a very simple way. Basically, instead of the equal weight superposition of all possible loop coverings, there's a coupling, which is, for example, when a blue loop is resonating, there's a relative minus sign if on that plaquette, red and green intersect. Simple enough, OK? And so that's kind of a simple way. This is the wave function we ended up preparing on this machine. This kind of a twisted version, or, you know, kind of a twisted version in some sense of this simpler toric code. But it turns out the simple extra ingredient makes all the difference and makes for a non-abelian topological order. In particular, let me just tell you that, you know, for toric code, we saw that if you break open a string, right, there's a E anion there. So here, similarly, open strings have certain anions, which we call M. Of course, there's three different colors because they have an open red string, open green, or open blue. But the special thing is you can show they're non-abelian. OK, I won't prove it, but with this phase factor, you can show that having an open string is really a non-abelian thing. So it has kind of an internal color label, just like quarks do. And then there's also an abelian anion, which is basically if you violate this plaquette, this resonance condition, that's an abelian anion. So I don't imagine that's maybe not entirely digestible, but I just want to give you a sense that the simple wave function has some simple anions, which we can fully understand, and some of them are non-abelian. OK? And this is an example of what I mentioned before, where you can actually check if I create a blue non-abelian pair and a green non-abelian pair, and I interlink them in space-time, by the time I fuse them, I produce a charge of the third color. This can only happen for non-abelian anions. I'm kind of toggling the internal space, changing the color index, if you wish. OK, good. So with that, let's go to the actual experiment. I just want to tell you, how do we know we prepared the state? We have to measure it, right? So there's certain stabilizers associated to this wave function I just showed. Maybe they look a bit scary. Let me go back. So remember, this loop was just a visual notation of qubits living on the bonds of these honeycomb lattices. Okay, and you can convince yourself that qubits living on the bonds of these interleaved honeycomb lattices is a Kagome lattice. Okay, you can stare at it a bit more later. You can say Kagome lattice. And these are exactly the stabilizers. For example, there's a three-body stabilizer, which tells you that loops are closed. And there's this 12-body beast, which is, you see some six poly excess. These are the resonance, right, moves. But the resonance, the sign of that depends on the state of the other two sublattices. Okay, so maybe you can just believe that these are the states that, you know, define this wave function. As long as you're happy with the wave function, these are just the, you know, the observables that confirm you created it. So we want to create a state. In particular, we do it on a torus geometry. So periodic boundary conditions on this 3x3 torus with 27 qubits. And then we will measure these observables to confirm that it worked. Okay. So let me skip. This is our theoretical proposal. You know, it's just a bunch of entangling gates. Basically, it's importing from the previous part of the talk where we did this gauging map using measurement. Let's just go to the results. So what I'm showing here, for each plaquette, so here's my 3x3 Kagome lattice. So it's 27 qubits. And this is the actual experimental outcome of the Quantinuum's device. And for each plaquette, I'm showing the expectation values of these three-body observables. So just to remind you, it's up here. For example, let's look at this plaquette. This triangle is about this blue, the three blue qubits. And I'm looking at the ZZZ stabilizer, this one, okay, on these three blue ones. And for example, we experimentally see that the expectation value is 0.95. Now, ideally, it would be 1. Yeah?
Experiments can measure products of so many qubits.
Yeah, so what you do is, so once you prepare the state and you want to measure this multi-body observable, you introduce an ancilla and drew unitaries such that measuring the ancilla is equivalent to have done them. It's like basically, you know, unwrapping the 12-body observable into a single side observable and measuring that. Which also means we have to do the measurement in three parallel runs, because you can't do that basis for all plaquettes at once. But yeah, can make it work. And this is how we get these numbers. And ideally, all of these numbers would be 1. For example, this is the expectation of all this 12-body guy. And we still get, say, 0.94 on this plaquette. And so, of course, this is not 1. If it was 1, we would get ideal preparation. We get some, you know, close to 1. And we can actually lower, you know, the total fidelity of this 27-qubit wave function compared to the ideal wave function of this resonating loop state is 75%. So that's pretty close for a 27-qubit system. And once we have this state, I won't really drag you through it, but you can create non-abelian anions on top and move them. For example, here, I'm creating non-abelian anions on this and this plaquette. And then as a function of time, I'm wrapping them around the system. In this case, not much happens. I just kind of, you can kind of see, I'm dragging it around in a closed loop. And then I fuse it back, and I get back to the original wave function, as it should be. It's basically creating a pair, doing nothing, fusing it back, getting back to the vacuum. But this is more like a sanity check. The interesting stuff happens once you braid two of them. Right? You wanted to check, for example, I told you before, that if I braid two of these non-abelians, by the time I fuse them, I should produce an anion of the third color. And indeed, this is kind of what happens. So maybe these little sketch pictures are a bit easier to digest than the actual experimental data. So we kind of create two blue and two green pairs as a function of time. Say I braid green around blue. By the time I fuse green, I get a red anion, which indeed is measured by this star term being minus 0.8 now, rather than positive. So its value has toggled. There's an anion sitting here. And then I continue to, you know, braid the blue one to itself. I fuse it, and I get minus 1. So we see we can kind of confirm this expected non-abelian braiding property. And maybe the last thing I want to show, the last kind of a fun experiment, is we want to have really kind of a smoking gun signature of non-abelian braiding statistics to really exemplify something abelian anions cannot do, which is abelian anions are kind of bad at knot theory, right? So I already showed you that if I have E and M anions and I link them in space-time, I can get a minus 1 phase factor, right? That's kind of an abelian anion's change statistics. But abelian anions are only sensitive to linking. Okay, and indeed, there's a linking between this world line and this world line. But there are knots that don't have linking. And it's actually kind of fun that Nat Tantevasarekhan, one of the collaborators, did the PSI program here. And for his PSI essay, he was actually reading up on SPT invariants and was learning about Borromean braiding. So is the he knew exactly what we needed to look at. Apparently, we needed to look at the coat of arms of an Italian family, the House of Borromeo, from many centuries ago. And if you look at their coat of arms, they have these three interleaved rings. Okay, and here I reproduce it slightly bigger. So these three rings. What is interesting, if you ignore any of the, like ignore the green one, you see blue and red are not linked, right? Or if you ignore blue, red and green are not linked. But at the same time, you can't pull them apart. There is some non-trivial linking, even though it's not pairwise linking. House of Borromeo liked it because it represents the important allies between three families. And if anyone abandons, then everything falls apart. So with that same drama, we want to see, can the non-abelians do it for us? Because if we only had abelian anions and we trace them in space-time, they have to have a trivial phase factor. Abelian anions cannot detect this. They can only detect pairwise linking. But we checked in just a time, let me just not go through it, but we did some process in space-time, which is equivalent to Borromean braiding. And the theory prediction is minus one, and we get very close to that in the actual continuum experiment. Let me skip this. This is just different ground states and topological sectors on the torus that we can get, even getting 22 ground states or a single anion on a torus, which surprises us initially. OK, so sorry for running over time. So basically, we see that measurements can speed up state preparation, kind of both on the conceptual side, but you can also implement these ideas. And there's a bunch of fun open directions to explore. For example, we see that certain states are easier to prepare than others. Can we link that to the computational power of these states for quantum computation purposes? And can we prove no-go theorems for certain states that we can't produce even with measurement? And also be interesting to stabilize these states we've created by doing active error correction. And also want to point out an interesting paper by Nature that recently got published, where they braid non-abelian defects, which is something I didn't really discuss. But anions are like point-like excitations. Defects are extended excitations. But they can also have non-abelian properties. I'm interested to kind of compare to anions, like what's the difference in computational power. With that, I want to thank you and also thank my lovely collaborators once again. And thank you all for your time and attention.
So I remember you discussed about the advantage of the ion trap computer in order to like realize this system. But at the same, like on the other hand, I wonder whether the other platforms like Rydberg atomary or like superconducting qubit has some disadvantages that prevent us from the like realization of this like non-abelian state. Or are there the reasons why you decided to choose the ion trap quantum computer?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think just at the moment, the ion trap experiment actually can do the feed forward. That's a key step. Like it can do a circuit, it can do a measurement, get the outcome, based on that outcome, feedback on your quantum system actively. So you don't need to do anything in post-processing. You can deterministically prepare a state. I'm not aware at the moment. Well, I think other platforms are coming on the market that might have the same capabilities. I'm sure in a few years, like Rydberg Adams will be up and running with the same capabilities, perhaps, or superconducting qubits, perhaps. I can't quite judge, right? But that's the main difference at the moment. I think it's hard to compare to ions in terms of that ability to do measurement and feed forward. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
So in this subsequent gauging procedure, do you only create abelian anions so you can efficiently pair them up, right?
That's a great question. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So can I understand that as so when I do the second step, the second gauging, that those non-abelian anions should be associated to taking the conjugation class of the previous abelian anions. So once I clear all of them in the first step, I won't create those non-abelian anions in the second step.
That sounds correct to me. Yeah. Uh-huh. I have to think about it more carefully, but that sounds like the right track. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So indeed, the disorder you produce by measurement is not gonna, create these other excitations that you worry about.
Thank you.
So using this method, you can only create something like a semi-direct product group.
That's a good, yeah. So the success, the way I was introducing that on that slide, indeed, is the semi-direct extensions. But by preceding the measurement by stacking with a semi-rigid bracket topological phase, which I glossed over, you can also look at non-split extensions, actually. Actually, for D4, we ended up doing that, even though, just for interest of time, I glossed over it. But you can extend it to non-split case. Yeah. But thanks for the question.
One of the problems with quantum computing is the error called threshold. You need a large number of physical qubits to use logical qubits. In fact, a very large number. So how does this, you say, link between computational power and difficulty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. So indeed, I would say the easiest ones to prepare are the so-called surface codes that have been most studied, also theoretically. And there, we know there's this big overhead in the number of physical qubits you need. The hope is indeed that non-abelian states require less overhead. And you know, definitely certain non-abelian states seem to imply that you need less overhead. But there's many different types of non-abelian states. And I would say that for the ones that we're creating, there's just simply not that much work, theoretical work, having done, like precisely, you know, what are all the pieces of error correction you need and what is the minimal ingredients you need. So I think hopefully some of these experiments will now motivate some of those studies and see, can we decrease, you know, can we lower the requirements we need? But I think it's too early to tell. But that would need be a hope, but it's too early to tell.
The number of states increases by 2 to the n.
Sorry, can you say again?
The number of states increases like 2 to the power n. It goes up very rapidly.
I see. Yeah, I'm not sure about the scale. Okay, I can't comment. Yeah, that doesn't sound good. Yeah, I don't know about the scaling.
It was skeptical.
I see. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. I wouldn't bet one way or another, but I think it's fun to explore and see where we end up.
In terms of gates that can perform the D, where is that D4 topological order? It's probably not universal.
Oh, yeah, correct. Yeah, correct. So, well, it's not known to be universal.
Oh, okay.
It's hard to prove something is not, so,
Okay.
But I should mention here, we also have other proposals for S3, and there, by work by Monchon, we know it's not braiding universal like Fibonacci, but it is universal once you use measurement, which is still scalable. And with the same ingredients we have, we could prepare it. If once we have a bigger system size, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah. So in my understanding, like this state preparation is in the absence of the Hamiltonian, like for example, that observes this like non-abelian like statistics. So I just wonder like whether there can be some like problems of this like absence of the Hamiltonian that like observes this.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say, the Hamiltonian is not necessary to define non-abelian topological order, non-abelian anions, right? Because that's why I try to emphasize the wave function, like you can deduce all these notions. The key point where Hamiltonian would be very helpful is stabilizing the state. Right? If you just leave it, right? If it's a low energy state, you're good, right? Of course, you might still, in practice, still have to do some error correction. But in absence of Hamiltonian, you're going to do definitely a lot of error correction. So going forward, you would have to do, there's also this line here, going forward, you have to do the same ingredients we used to prepare a state. You keep repeating it to kind of stabilize it. At the same time, you could try to do some logical operations on your system.
But if you have the Hamiltonian, then we do not need active error correction? Or like, how does it
work? Yeah, it's a good question. I think most people expect that you still need some error correction, because any finite temperature eventually going to mess things up. But that's just that it's much more stable. Like it's a quantitative difference rather than a purely qualitative one, I would say.
Understand. Thank you so much.
All right, let's thank Ruben again.
Thank you.